three bushes, the cosmos, and then this is what we see, cosmic landscape. And but another boundary bush is the smallest. And tonight's lecture is sponsored by the High Energy Frontier Theory Initiative. And that is an initiative to use high energy particles to probe the smallest, the most fundamental particles. And this is the initiative we have called HEFTI, High Energy Frontier Theory Initiative. And may I tonight introduce the principal of this initiative, Professor Jack Gunyan. Professor Jack Gunyan, to introduce the speaker tonight.
Thank you, Winston. Winston, along with our former Dean Roth, who unfortunately passed away, just had a memorial service for our unique among deans since I've been here at Davis, which has been a long time now, I hate to admit, and having a real vision for what's, at least in my opinion, important, and this has led to a lot of really exciting things. Anyway, it's my pleasure tonight to introduce tonight's speaker to you. And unlike the usual apocryphal picture of the typical theoretical physicist, Lenny Susskind, what we call him, is actually a very interesting person. He's amusing. I'm sure you'll enjoy his talk, but his history is kind of amusing as well. His father was a prize fighter in his youth, and then a plumber, as I learned today, working for the mafia and things like that in the Bronx in New York, where Lenny grew up. And Lenny worked as a plumber for a while, and then even spent a year or so doing plumbing engineering, and then the metamorphosis occurred, and he became a theoretical physicist. Well, don't ask me how this happened, but this was done under the erstwhile guidance of Hans Bethe, a very well-known physicist at Cornell. And following that, well, of course, Lenny was always his own man, if nothing else. He's certainly his own man, but he's had many, many very original ideas and been a real leader and inspiration to all of us. So after Cornell, he spent a period at Tel Aviv University and then went on to Stanford University in 1978, where he is now Felix Bloch Professor of Theoretical Physics. His work has been honored by membership in the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And just to give you a little history of what he's going to talk about tonight, in the 1970s, I remember very well, because I was working on the same sort of things, Lenny became very interested in how quarks, these are the things that are supposed to be inside protons, how they were confined inside protons. And one picture was that they were held together by a string of what we call flux. Think of it as a rubber band or something like that. And of course, rubber bands vibrate, right? And so Lenny said, well, let's try to formulate this in a mathematically sensible way. And that made him the father of string theory. And in many ways, his metamorphosis from plumber to theoretical physicist is an allegory for the many metamorphoses that string theory has in fact undergone. Nowadays, we think not of string theory as being how quarks are inside protons, but rather every quark, every electron, and every particle, very elementary particle, is itself supposed to be a string, some kind of vibration of a string. So this string theory has undergone many metamorphoses, as you'll learn. The genie is sort of out of the bottle, and we're continuing to think about it. What the string theory really means, and each time the genie emerges from the bottle, it's sort of in a different form, and this has led to the concept of the cosmic landscape and the ability to scientifically, as opposed to philosophically, discuss the illusion of intelligent design. String theory suggests that the world as we know it is balanced on a knife edge. It's kind of why we are here and what have you is really a knife edge balancing act. So Lenny will tell us all about this. Please join me in welcoming Lenny Susskind.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack. I have to warn you, I am terrified of this machine, this piece of high technology here. It always goes wrong during my talk. So don't be surprised if the whole thing just explodes. In fact, I'll tell you a story. How my fear of audiovisual aids emerged. I was a very young physicist. I think I was 22 years old. I was an undergraduate. And I was invited to the Institute for Advanced Study to give a lecture. Now, the Institute for Advanced Study, that's where J. Robert Oppenheimer was and all these people, and I was scared as hell. I lived in the Bronx with my mother and my father, and my mother said, look, you've got to get properly dressed for this. You've got to have a suit. Well, I didn't own a suit, so she took me down to Alexander's. Alexander's was a store on 40th Road in the Bronx, a discount store, and she bought me a suit which cost, I think, $7. The suit cost $7, but I needed a tie also. So she bought me a tie. The tie was a bright red tie, and it looked like it was made of cellophane. Does anybody remember cellophane paper?
Sure.
It looked like it was made of cellophane paper, and I put it on. I don't even know if I was old enough to drive. Yes, I was old enough to drive, but somebody drove me down to the Institute for Advanced Study. And I, in those days, you have to understand, we didn't have computers. We didn't even have overhead projectors. I'm quite old. We have something called a opaque projector. Raise your hand if you remember an opaque projector. Okay. So an opaque projector is you put your ordinary drawings into it, and then it had a lever. You pull the lever down, and down came a light. And the light was quite hot. It was really very hot, actually. And it came close to the paper, and somehow magically it appeared on the blackboard. It was called an opaque projector. In any case, I was terrified. And I have to tell you, when I'm terrified, you will discover this during the question period. When you ask me a terrifying question, I have this passive-aggressive streak. And it wasn't J. Robert Oppenheimer, but it was one of his buddies who asked me a very difficult question. And I started to lecture him. I started to lecture him. Very famous man. His name was Murph Goldberger, extremely famous. And during the time that I was lecturing him, I decided to show him one of my transparencies, one of my opaque things. And so I put it in, leaned over all the time, going like this, pulled down the lever, and then discovered I couldn't stand up. Well, I couldn't. I had to take it, pretend that I was naturally not moving. But then all of a sudden, the heat all of a sudden took a hold of my tie and burst into flame. Burst into flame, and Goldberger, who was sitting in the front row being lectured to, quickly on his feet, took his glass of water and threw it in my face. That is how I learned humility. I tell you that story just to protect myself in case this machine blows up in my face. But in any case, what I'm really going to talk about is not my experiences with red cellophane ties, but a thing which is happening in science, a thing which is happening in physics and cosmology, which is almost unprecedented in physics and cosmology, although it is precedented in other parts of science. It's a controversy, and it's a controversy which had a predecessor about 150 years ago. 150 years ago, or a little more than 150 years ago, there was a gentleman named Reverend William Paley. And Reverend William Paley was a very smart cookie. He is, by all means, the person who invented the theory of intelligent design. I don't believe he was a right-wing person or anything like that. He was not a political person. He was a thinker. And his thoughts went something like this. He said, supposing you're out walking on the beach and you discover on the beach a wristwatch. Well, in those days, I don't think there were wristwatches. There were probably pocket watches. You discover on the beach, lying on the beach, a pocket watch. What is your conclusion? Well, one possible conclusion is that an incredible accident happened. A whole bunch of random parts just came together and made a watch. William Paley correctly said, that's highly improbable. He doesn't believe it. It doesn't seem like the right story. His conclusion was that if you found such a watch, it would probably mean there was a designer, somebody who made the watch, that the watch was designed by an intelligence. How could anything that complicated suddenly spontaneously appear? And I think we would all agree with him. If we found the watch, we would conclude somebody made that watch. Well, William Paley went a little bit further, and he said, we find the eyeball and other interesting human parts, but in particular he focused on the eyeball. And he said the eye is an incredibly complicated object. In many ways, it is more complicated and more fine-tuned and more refined than a wristwatch. What can we conclude by the fact that in nature we find eyes? The answer can only be, he said, in analogy with a watch, that there is a designer. Now, that of course is Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin was very, very impressed by this argument. It is wrong to think that Charles Darwin, at the age of 3, thought of the theory of evolution. Not at all. He was a religious man, like most people at that time, and he believed, according to historical record, that William Paley had proved the existence of God. And he went through a good fraction of his life believing that that the existence of such complicated machinery, such fine-tuned machinery, as eyeballs and so forth, indicated that, yes, there was a intelligence that had created the world, that had created life, and so forth. Now, we all know the story that that he thought about it harder. He was a curious man, not willing and not content with that solution, thought about it very hard, and came eventually to a very different conclusion, rather reluctantly. So reluctantly that that he refused to talk about it for a good number of years, for about 20 years, but he came to another conclusion. We know what that other conclusion was. Basically, the other conclusion is that through a process of random mutation and selection, but it's not selection that I want to focus on here, it's random mutation, that life tries out a bit of everything. It branches into an incredibly complicated tree, and there's only a very small number of branches that actually wind up successful. Those successful branches wind up being rather special looking, but really it's just a process of random mutation, trying out this, trying out that, and eventually some complex organisms will form, and those complex organisms, and in particular he explained, at least in the rough terms, how the eyeball might have formed by a process of random mutation. The tree of life, or the bush of life, it's probably more interesting to think of it as a bush which grows off in every direction rather than something which grows vertically. That was Darwin's great contribution, of course. Now, at the present time, 150 years later, physics and cosmology are going through a very similar kind of crisis. In particular, the world as we know it, the universe as we know it, appears to be very special and very, very fine-tuned. Fine-tuned in such a way that it allows life. I will talk about some of these fine-tunings, but let's just accept for the moment that there are many, many things about the universe and about the laws that govern the universe that appear to be so very, very special that perhaps it would be unreasonable to think of them as accidents. Physics and cosmology are going through exactly the same crisis now, with, again, basically three possibilities. One is that it's just an accident. Many physicists for many years, including myself, felt that the explanation of the universe was some sort of mathematical explanation, some special, elegant, special, super special mathematical principle, and that super special mathematical principle created a world that just by accident, just by the luck of the draw, so to speak, happened to have the ingredients necessary for planets, for galaxies, for planets, for stars, and so forth, all the things we need for the existence of chemistry, for the existence of atoms, and eventually for organic chemistry, and eventually for our own existence, that it was just an accident, and an accident of just accidental. That's one possible explanation. Now, one question is, are these special features really so terribly special that we should dismiss the possibility of accident the way that William Paley dismissed the possibility of accident for the wristwatch, and we'll come to that. But the second possibility is, of course, the designer. That, in fact, that the world was designed by an intelligence, designed by an intelligence to create the world just so that human life could exist.
Is there a point you made, chance?
It doesn't matter, never mind. Don't worry, Jack, don't worry about it. the second possibility that comes to mind very naturally is the existence of a designer. The existence of a designer, and one has to admit this is an intellectual possibility. No doubt somebody will ask me why I don't believe it later in this evening, and it's not that I don't believe it, but I will talk about, be glad to discuss with you why I don't think science goes in that direction at the present time. The third possibility is something more like Darwin. Something more along the lines of a natural explanation which involves statistics, random trying until a universe is created which has the properties which are necessary for our own existence. Now, what are these special properties? What are these incredible accidents that I'm speaking of which are so extraordinary that we even bother asking this question? Why do we question whether it might not just be an accident? Well, let's go through. What do we take? What does it take for life? Life is chemistry. Well, life is based on chemistry. Chemistry is based on atoms and molecules. And atoms and molecules trace their existence back to the elementary particles. If we understand why the elementary particles are the way they are, then we can move forward from there to atoms, to molecules, and eventually to life. So it goes back to the elementary particles. This is going to be a very quick course in elementary particle physics. Basically, I will tell you the names of a whole bunch of particles. Can you hear me if I don't stand by the microphone?
Yep.
There's a whole bunch of particles, graviton, photon, neutrino, electron, gluon, quark, W boson, Z boson, Higgs boson, inflaton, a whole bunch of them whose physicists have been inventing these things, discovering them. Some of them are actually discovered, some of them are still hypothetical. But basically, these are all the particles that are necessary to our own existence, and we believe they all exist. There are a whole bunch of other particles, no, not so many, a handful actually, which are absolutely unnecessary for our existence as far as we know, and they also appear to exist. These particles also exist. There are also, in addition to the particles, a collection of numbers, the constants of nature. Written down here happens to be the masses of the particles, and the masses of the particles in units of the electron mass, so the electron is just one, and here are all the other masses of the particles. Now you'll notice that there's an interesting pattern here. The interesting pattern is that the masses increase. The only reason for that pattern is because I wrote the particles down in order of increasing mass. No other reason. So there is this incredible collection of numbers, a random collection of particles, and some that we need, some that we don't need. But quite honestly, anybody who tells you that elementary particle physics is an elegant subject is trying to sell you snake oil. This is not an elegant subject. Parts of it are very elegant. Aspects of it are very elegant, but there's a tremendous amount of inelegance, redundancy, too many particles, too many constants of nature, and in fact, if you added up all the constants of nature, I've only put down a few of them here, there may be most likely hundreds of them. Where do they come from? It's a monstrosity in many senses. In fact, it reminds me, it sort of embarrasses me to talk about elementary particle physics in front of a lay audience because it looks all so artificial. It looks like, to me, a Rube Goldberg machine. Everybody know what a Rube Goldberg machine is? Of course you do. The cat will not fall off the stage. Rube Goldberg machine is a silly machine which has a whole bunch of silly ingredients whose purpose is to do some job, but it does it in the worst possible engineering sense. In the sense of engineering, it does it in the worst possible way. Here's Rube Goldberg's picture-taking machine. The photographer sits on a bag of gas. The gas blows out and blows on an ice boat. The ice boat pushes a cigar. The cigar explodes a balloon. This exploding balloon scares the dictator, who thinks he's been shot. He falls over and falls onto the picture-taking, clicking thing, and takes a picture. This thing would work. It would work, right? It would work. But on the other hand, who on earth would design anything as complicated as this? Well, to many of us, the theory of elementary particles looks like a Rube Goldberg machine. It does its job, namely, it creates a universe in which life is possible, but it's awfully damn complicated. And why is it the way it is? Now, let me tell you why we need these particular particles. The easiest ones to understand are, of course, the electron and the quarks. The electron, that's necessary for atoms. Atoms are electrons moving around nuclei. Nuclei are made out of quarks, and so without quarks and electrons, we couldn't have atoms. Another particle that we desperately need is the photon. Why do we need the photon? The photon is light. It's light and it's heat. We need it to warm us from the sun, for example. But maybe life can exist in a cold place. Maybe you don't really need to be warmed by the sun. In fact, we need the photon for a much, much deeper reason. The photon is the object which jumps back and forth. Here's a picture of an atom. This is my extremely crude version of a video. I made this myself. I'm very proud of it. Oops. The photon is the white golf ball in the center. It jumps back and forth between the nucleus and the electron. And the jumping back and forth is the thing that creates the force which holds the electron in orbit. Without the photon as an elementary particle, atoms would just disintegrate and fall apart. The gluon, which was on the previous page, is an object which jumps back and forth and holds the nucleus together. So the gluon is also necessary to our own existence. Those are the particles that we need to have chemistry. But we need something else besides the mathematical possibility of chemistry, of atoms and molecules to have chemistry. We need chemicals. Where did the chemicals in the universe come from? The place the chemicals in the universe came from is the interior of hot stars. The early universe was mostly all hydrogen and helium. You cannot make life from hydrogen and helium. It's not complex enough. Where did all the other elements, the carbon, phosphorus, the oxygen, all the other things that we need for life, where did they come from? They were cooked in the interior of stars, in the thermonuclear furnaces of stars. And they were cooked by nuclear reactions. Here's a picture of some of the nuclear reactions that went on. The most important thing was the creation of neutrons out of protons. Neutrons can be created from protons by a process, and these are Feynman diagrams. If you recognize them, fine. If you don't recognize them, I will simply tell you that this is a Feynman diagram representing how a proton can become a neutron. But to do so, it has to emit a W boson, and then the W boson has to become a neutrino and a positron. So, in order to have elements cooked in stars, we need these W bosons. We also need the neutrino. This is why I told you that we need all of those particles in order to exist. Without them, the chemicals of life could not exist. Here's another process, a more complicated one that actually does take place in a star, and creates the neutrons. Here we would create a neutron next to a proton. The neutron and proton stick together and form the first simplest nucleus. And by a series of similar processes, the heavy elements, the ordinary elements, were built up. Okay, but what good are elements stuck inside hot stars? You can't live in a hot star. It's just too hot. And so what good are they? They're no good in the interior of stars. Just too hot. We can't live there. Fortunately, stars don't live forever. They die. And some fraction of them, depending on their mass and their properties, disappear in a tremendous implosion. Those implosions are called supernovae. Supernovae. That's a picture of the Crab Nebula, and it is a supernova, and those are the remnants. Now, if you notice, I said the word implosion. What happens is the star collapses. What good is that? That sounds like all the elements get sucked in. Well, they do get sucked in, except for one thing, that in the process of the internal guts of the supernova, a whole bunch of neutrinos, a huge number of neutrinos is emitted. And those neutrinos flying out from the interior of the supernova, they push ahead of them. Here's a neutrino, and it interacts with protons, for example, by a Z boson jumping back and forth. That creates a force between the neutrino and the proton. The result is that the neutrinos flying out push ahead of them, or a pressure, create a pressure that pushes ahead of them the elements that were cooked at the outer exterior of the star, and push them out into space where they can be recycled in next generation stars to form planets, stars, planets, and so forth, but in particular planets. And that is where we came from. Now, the reason I drew this particular graph was to also show you why the Z boson happens to be necessary to our own existence. The message here is there's a lot of stuff in elementary particle physics which is luckily just right in order to create a world which looks like our own with chemistry, with atoms, and so forth. What about gravity? Let's come to gravity. Do we need gravity for our existence? Oh, you bet we need gravity for our existence. Without gravity, among other things, we wouldn't stick to the Earth. We would just float off into outer space. That wouldn't be good for us. As a matter of fact, it's worse than that. The Earth wouldn't stick together. It would just fly apart. So, yes, our existence is dependent on the existence of gravity. Now, in most of our daily lives, gravity seems to be the most important force. It feels stronger than anything else, especially as you get older. I remember my grandmother used to come home from Simpson Street shopping market carrying two heavy bags, and she would say, "Oy vey, I feel like 1,000 pounds. I don't ever remember her complaining about the electromagnetic or the nuclear force. But the fact is that gravity is the weakest of all forces, by many orders of magnitude. If you were to take the gravitational attraction between the particles in an atom, they are 42 orders of magnitude weaker than the electrical forces, and even more weak than the forces that hold the nucleus together. So gravity is by far the weakest force in nature. The question is, why is it so much weaker? Well, we have some ideas, but basically the bottom line is we don't really know. Why is gravity 42 times weaker, 10 to the 42 times weaker? But I can tell you this, that if it were one or two orders of magnitude stronger, in other words, if it was 10 to the minus 41 or 10 to the minus 40, we would have been in trouble, bad trouble. The universe, instead of being dominated by the existence of planets and stars and galaxies, would be completely dominated by black holes, for one thing. There are other reasons also. But instead of having the kinds of objects that we can live on, the kinds of objects that warm us, the universe would be filled with black holes instead. Gravity would pull things together and create black holes. If by some fantastic accident an Earth-like planet formed, it wouldn't last very long in that environment. There are other things wrong with gravity being too strong. It would make stars burn too fast. In fact, it would make the whole universe evolve too fast and would not allow time for our own evolution. So the fact that gravity is 42 orders of magnitude weaker than the other forces in nature is important to our own existence. And we really don't have a complete theory of why it is 42 orders of magnitude weaker. It just is. So what? So what, in the sense, could these all be accidents? Could these just be the accidental properties of some fundamental mathematical theory? And when you grind through the mathematics, work out the consequences of some beautiful equation. Yes, you find all of these things are there. And in that sense, it's all just an accident that we're here. Yes, I would say the things that I've showed you up to now, physicists have known about for a long time, and most physicists have taken the view, this is just a piece of luck that the universe is the way it is. Nothing is all that fine-tuned. Nothing is all that extraordinary. Incidentally, there are some explanations about why gravity is so weak. They're tentative, and we don't know if they're right yet, but there are some explanations, mathematical explanations. And so, if that was all, I think we would not jump to the conclusion that there's some kind of funny thing going on that requires an explanation. The real kicker, the real thing which has pushed this question front and center to the front and center of physics and cosmology is a thing called the cosmological constant. Let me tell you about the cosmological constant. It's an aspect of gravity. Everybody knows that Newton invented gravity. Well, Newton didn't invent gravity. Newton discovered gravity. Newton explained gravity. No, none of these are right. Newton described gravity. And he described gravity by a gravitational force which is proportional to the product of masses of objects, inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them, et cetera, et cetera. Most of you have seen this formula. Some of you may not. This is Newton's universal formula for gravity. Now, Einstein came along and explained Newton's theory in geometric terms. This is not important to us right now, but Einstein realized for a variety of reasons that there was an ambiguity in his own equations, and that, in fact, his own equations permitted another term in the force law. This term is meant to be a kind of repulsion. It's a repulsion which is proportional to distance. So the further out you go, the more you are repelled from everything else. And furthermore, there is a constant, a numerical constant, which Einstein said could be anything, any number, and he called it the cosmological constant. It's a kind of universal repulsion. A kind of universal repulsion or anti-gravity. But it's only important when the distances are very, very large, according to Einstein. Well, that ambiguity was there in his equations, but Einstein very quickly decided that it was an ugly monstrosity, and he said, I am going to take it back. It was my worst mistake. I hereby declare that lambda is zero, and there is no such thing as this cosmic repulsion or this cosmological constant. Well, the trouble with that is once Pandora's box is opened, once you realize a thing is possible, then you require an explanation of why it isn't there. And physicists have failed for the last 70 years or more to explain why that constant isn't there. But things are worse than that. They have a very, very good reason to believe that there should be a cosmological constant, and a very big cosmological constant. So let me tell you another word for the cosmological constant. Incidentally, one word for it is called dark energy. It's the same as dark energy, or probably the same as dark energy. But there's another word that we use for it, which is called vacuum energy. Now, it's not the energy of a vacuum cleaner, and it's not the energy of the young woman who was using the vacuum cleaner. It is the energy of empty space. How can empty space have energy? That's ridiculous. Empty space is empty. How can it have energy? Well, according to quantum mechanics, empty space is not so empty. It is full of vibrating, fluctuating fields, electric fields, magnetic fields, and all other kinds of fields, gravitational fields. Every kind of field that exists in nature is present in the vacuum, and it's constantly fluctuating. That's a consequence of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics makes everything jitter. Even the vacuum is full of jittering, fluctuating fields. Here's a kind of picture of a vacuum. This my son made for me. This is roughly, if you could expand it out and make it as big as make everything big enough to see, the vacuum would fluctuate like this. What is it that's fluctuating? Electric field, magnetic field, gravitational field. The universe would be full of fluctuation. That fluctuation, it's just empty space, what we ordinarily call empty space, full of stuff going on constantly. We can measure that stuff, in fact, constantly going on. But in order to measure it, we have to do very delicate experiments. Right? That energy is vacuum energy, and it is cosmological constant. There should be a cosmological constant according to every theory that's ever been written down that can possibly explain nature, and yet the cosmological constant seems not to really exist. How do we know that it doesn't exist? If it existed at anything like the magnitude that physicists would calculate, if they calculated the vacuum energy from their own equations, it would create a pressure, it would create a repulsive pressure which would be so big, so enormously big, that it would easily shatter the Earth, it would shatter molecules, it would shatter atoms, it would shatter even elementary particles. If there was a vacuum energy as big as physicists have always estimated, it would certainly be deadly to our own existence. It would create this outward force, this repulsion that Einstein said isn't there. He's right, hardly there at all. And so if it exists, if Einstein's famous lambda, the cosmological constant, if it exists at all, it must be a very, very small number. Otherwise, it would lead to the destruction of everything. How small a number? Let me illustrate how small a number. That's a pretty small number, right? You have to put that's zero. Put another number in at the end. That's a damn small number, right? You measure anything and it's that small, you're pretty sure it's zero. Well, that's not small enough. That small? No, not small enough. That's how small the cosmological constant has to be in order that the universe, as we see it and as we know it, not be disrupted, that's the observational bound on the cosmological constant. It cannot be bigger than that in order that it does not disrupt the motions of galaxies and everything that we know about the universe. There are, incidentally, about 120 zeros there. 10 to the minus 120. That's how small the cosmological constant has to be. And we have no idea why it is that small. The natural expectation is that it's zero, absolutely zero. If that many decimal places are zero, it must be for a good reason. Well, I want to tell you a story now of an analogous situation. The analogous situation is a made-up story. This is not real. This is not a true story. This is a made-up story to illustrate the logic which is now going on in physics. And it's the story of the big-brained fish. The big-brained fish were a race of fish that lived under the sea, and they lived on a planet where it was completely covered by cloud. They could not see above their planet. In fact, they couldn't get out of the water altogether. They had to live at a certain depth. And there they were, but they were big-brained, they were smart, they were so smart, and the smartest among them were called physicists. I don't really think physicists are necessarily the smartest fish. They had a question. They said they learned all about water. They knew everything about water. They knew about steam, they knew about ice, they knew about everything, they knew about its molecular structure, they knew about its nuclear structure. There was one thing they couldn't figure out. They couldn't figure out why they were so lucky that their environment happened to be in the narrow, narrow range of possibilities where water would be liquid. It is a very narrow range, incidentally. If plotted in the right way, it's a very narrow range that water can be liquid. Why were they so lucky? Well, they started looking for explanations. They looked for mathematical explanations. They looked for an equation that would predict the temperature. They wanted a temperature of about, 60, 70 degrees Fahrenheit or whatever, so they looked for an equation that would explain to them why the temperature was right between the middle between ice and steam. And they never found such an equation. They looked for a relaxation mechanism, something which would take any temperature and make it always tend to between ice and water. And they found nothing. They could never explain it. Meanwhile, at the same time, there was another group who were allied with the physicists, and they were called the cosmologists. And the cosmologists were interested in a different set of questions. They were interested in what might lie above the surface. What might lie above the cloud bank? And they had an idea, or at least some of them had an idea. The idea went as follows. Maybe for some odd reason, nature necessarily has to be such that there can be fish which can ask the question, why is nature the way it is? Now that sounds exceedingly silly. They had a name for this principle. It was called the ichthyopic principle. The ichthyopic principle said exactly that. Nature must be such that fish can live in order to be able to question why nature is the way it is. That sounds extremely silly, but I have to say that there are a large number of physicists,
including myself,
who believe that. Okay. Well, what is it that the cosmologists really believe? Some of them actually had an explanation of this behavior. And the explanation went as follows. The thing that they lived on, their waterverse, their neighborhood where they lived, was only one of a very small number of similar objects in a very, very big space outside of where they could see. They could never see it because they couldn't get above the surface of the water. They could never see it because of the cloud bank. But they had the idea that there was a bigger universe out there with an enormous variety of different types of objects, some of them so hot that they could fuse hydrogen into helium, some of them so cold that liquid helium could exist on them. And a very small fraction of them just happened to be in the narrow band of temperatures where fish can exist. And so the natural conclusion is fish exist where fish can exist. And that's called the ichthyopic principle. Well, that's about the situation that physics is in. What about this cosmological constant? Why is it so small? We don't know why it's so small, but it's beginning to occur to us, and it's beginning to seem that it's a question very similar to the question of why the temperature is fine-tuned so that we can be, just so that fish can be here. In 1987, Steven Weinberg was the first one, as far as I know, I think there may have been other people, but Steven Weinberg, who's one of the most famous physicists in the world, maybe the most famous physicist, well, that's probably not true. Lee Smallman is probably the most famous physicist in the world. That's a joke. Steven Weinberg is one of the two or three most famous physicists in the world, and he began to question, in the same way that the cosmologists question their own environment, and he said, maybe it's true that if the cosmological constant was not that small, if it wasn't that 10 to the minus 120, or 10 to the minus 119, maybe we couldn't be here. And he started to think about it, and started to think about what mechanisms, why would a cosmological constant, a few times bigger than 10 to the minus 120, let's say 10 to the minus 80, or 10 to the minus 90, no, not, 10 to the minus 17, 117, 10 to the minus 116, would that be destructive to life? And at first sight, it doesn't seem like it would be. It's such a weak repulsion, the cosmological constant 10 to the minus 117, that it wouldn't have much influence on life altogether. But then he realized eventually that it would have a bad effect on creation. Not the creation of life, but the creation of planets, stars, and galaxies, and so forth, which we need to exist. And here's the way the argument went. The very early universe looked something like this. It was very homogeneous, not much structure. The hydrogen and helium, the little bit of helium that was there, filled the universe very homogeneously and very smoothly, with very little structure. But if you look carefully at this, and I don't know if you can see it, but you'll find some places which are a little bit over-dense. Here's another place which is a little bit over-dense. Perhaps you can see it from where you're sitting, but there are places which are a little bit under-dense. The over-dense regions are slightly brighter, the under-dense regions are slightly darker. The over-density was very small, only approximately 10 to the minus 5. There are density contrasts. How out of this did our galaxies and planets form? Well, they formed from gravity. Gravity started pulling together the over-dense regions, and sucking material out of the underdense regions, And the overdense regions became more overdense, and even more overdense, and eventually gravity collapsed them into galaxies and planets and so forth. But Weinberg asked, supposing there was a little bit of this cosmic repulsion, supposing the cosmic repulsion, Einstein's cosmological constant, was a little bit bigger than the observed bound that he knew about. Well, he made a calculation, and what he found out was that even that little bit of repulsion would have made it impossible for the attractive force of gravity to pull together the planets and galaxies. So he realized that, yes, a very, very small cosmological constant, a very, very fine-tuned cosmological constant, it must be that small, or else we couldn't be here. He found himself in exactly the same, physics now finds itself in exactly the same situation that the physicists found themselves in. They can't explain why things are fine-tuned like that, but if they weren't fine-tuned like that, they couldn't be there. In fact, Weinberg computed that if the cosmological constant were even an order of two of magnitude bigger than this very small number, that it would be deadly for our existence. But what he predicted was, he said, if the only reason that the cosmological constant is this small is so that we can be here, then it need not be much smaller than this. And therefore, I predict that when the next decimal place is measured, the cosmological constant will not be zero. And indeed, when it was measured about 5 years ago, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, a few years ago, the next decimal place was not zero. We seem to live in a world with a cosmological constant which is so small that it's unthinkable. This is an incredible situation. You measure something to 10 decimal places of zero, 20 decimal places of zero, 30 decimal places of zero, and you keep measuring and measuring, 100 decimal places, 110 decimal places, and still zero. What's the conclusion? The conclusion must be that the thing is exactly zero for some unknown reason. And then you measure it in 121st decimal place and discover that it's not zero. That is such a stunning fact that physicists have been reeling over it for the last 5, 6, 7 years, and largely don't know what to make out of it. But the question is, could the answer be the same as the cosmologist's answer? The cosmologist's answer is that the universe is very, very big and very, very diverse. Well, we know the universe is very, very big and much bigger than we can see through telescopes. It may be 10 to the 10th times bigger, it may be 10 to the 10th to the 10th to the 10th times bigger, we don't really know, but we know that it's extremely big. The question is whether it is all homogeneous, all everywhere the same. By everywhere the same, I mean the laws of physics are the same everywhere, as we always believed. The cosmological constant is the same everywhere. Or could the universe be somewhat like what the cosmologists thought, diverse, a patchwork of different environments, very, very different from one another, so many different possibilities that in some very, very small fraction, perhaps life can exist, and that would entail the cosmological constant being very small. Physicists have begun to suspect, some physicists, I suspect the majority of theoretical physicists by now, begin to question whether the universe may have places, and the enormous variety of places, where the laws of physics, though that Rube Goldberg machine that I showed you, is different, where the cosmological constant is different. There was such a large variety that on some very small fraction of the universe, life is possible, and that's where we live. Well, one of the things that is driving that idea, and I must say, almost all theoretical physicists hate that idea. Why? Because it would mean that there's no possibility of explaining everything in nature. Things would simply be diverse. They would be different here and there and so forth. Some things would be environmental. If some things are environmental, just aspects, accidental aspects of our environment, we can't explain them. Physicists hate this idea. I hated the idea. Steven Weinberg hated the idea. Every physicist practically hated the idea. the tipping point for many of us that made us start taking it seriously, that makes us continue to ask this question in a serious vein now, whether the universe might be big, diverse, and such that we can only live in a very small percentage of it, but that's where we live, it's called the anthropic principle. The tipping point came for me personally with properties of string theory. So let me tell you about the properties of string theory that bear on this issue. I'm not going to tell you very much about string theory. The most important thing I'm going to tell you about string theory is that it requires more than three dimensions of space. Strings, for mathematical reasons, which I am not going to try to explain here, like to get out of three-dimensional space and crawl into higher dimensions. They are not happy. You cannot show up very well, does it? Sort of worm crawling around on the x-axis, but it likes to crawl out into higher dimensions. String theory is a mathematical theory that does not make sense if there are only three dimensions. But there are only three dimensions. Up, out, sideways, there are only three dimensions. Why don't we just give up and say string theory is wrong? And the reason is because we know tricks how to hide extra dimensions. And those extra dimensions can be valuable and contribute new insight into elementary particle physics. Let me just show you very quickly what it means to hide a dimension of space. Here is a world which is one-dimensional. Creatures live on that world, and they move up and down that one-dimensional line, and they bang into each other. They can't help but bang into each other because the world is one-dimensional. That line is infinitely thin as far as they are concerned. Of course, they don't really stick out of the line. They're really composed out of things which are on the line. And they believe their world is one-dimensional because they keep banging into each other. So there's no question about it. On the other hand, if they look at that world through a very high-powered microscope, what they discover is that the line is really the surface of a cylinder. The surface of a cylinder is such that if it was small enough, much smaller than those creatures, maybe as small as the flies that are shown on here, you could move in two directions. You could move around the cylinder or you could move along the cylinder. In other words, in reality, they lived in a two-dimensional world. One of those dimensions is hidden because it's just too small. Well, elementary particles are really very, very small. And so the question is, could the world have more dimensions which are hidden, or which are important to the way elementary particles behave? According to string theory, the answer is yes, there must be more dimensions. The number happens to be six more dimensions. That's not important. Actually, it is important, but not for this lecture. What does a world with more dimensions look like? Well, the ordinary dimensions of space I've imagined to just be the horizontal surface of this tablecloth here. This is X, this is Y. Too many, I don't want to try to draw Z. These are the ordinary directions of space. And a big, gross creature, much bigger than this fly, would move around and not notice that at every point in space, there are other additional dimensions that you can move around in. Those other additional dimensions, however many of them there are, might be curled up into tiny geometries, geometries too small for us to see, but nevertheless complex and interesting. The structure of those geometries, according to string theory, is the DNA of the universe in the sense that it tells us how elementary particles behave. They move a little bit faster. That's an example of one of these geometries. They're called Calabi-Yau manifolds. And Calabi-Yau manifolds are complicated six-dimensional geometries. The main thing I want you to get out of this is that they're complicated. They have lots of holes and handles and Swiss cheese holes and so forth. They're very, very complicated. Right. So according to string theory, what's down there in small dimensions that you can't see is very complex structure. Okay. How many Calabi-Yau manifolds are there? Well, I used to ask my friends, and these are some of my friends. This is my friend Joe, my friend Eva, my friend Raphael. This is Joe Polchinski, who's one of the most famous physicists in the world. Eva Silverstein, who is a professor at Stanford. That was not a picture which was taken 30 years ago. That was a picture which was taken last year. This is Raphael Busso down at the bottom. They began to give me answers that I didn't expect. they began to tell me that the number of possible ways of making these Calabi-Yau manifolds was huge, 10 to the 500 of them, perhaps. The basic ingredient, which made it so large, which I'm not going to have time to tell you about, was that these Calabi-Yau manifolds have structures on them. They're called fluxes, and those fluxes can be rearranged in an enormous variety of ways. Rearranging them changes the laws of physics. If you just change the fluxes that decorate the Calabi-Yau manifold, everything changes. The elementary particle spectrum changes, the cosmological constant changes. And so what they discovered was there are a huge, huge number of possibilities inherent in string theory. This was a disaster from the string theory's point of view. They had always hoped that there would be a unique theory which by accident would permit life. And instead, what these people were finding is there were a huge number of possibilities. Well, I'm going to skip over some of the details. And what I'm going to tell you is how this landscape of possibilities, the landscape of possibilities of what it means, is the various enormous number of different possible ways of putting string theory together to make the universe. The plans, the blueprints, the space of blueprints of universes is so large that it could be as large as 10 to the 500. A disaster from the point of view of anybody who wants to explain why the world is exactly the way it is, but perhaps a boon to people who think that the universe might be so diverse that it might actually include places which were fine-tuned enough for our own existence. Let me show you, let me jump to the punchline for a moment. Let me jump to the punchline and tell you how this enormous variety of different environments inherent in string theory might have gotten created in the universe. Here's roughly. Now let's jump to the final conclusion. Let's jump to the final conclusion. We can come back. People can ask me questions when I come back to these. Here is the way we think things happen. This is a picture of an expanding universe. You can't see it expanding because it's all homogeneous. It's a rapidly expanding universe. It's an inflating universe which is exponentially expanding. It's exponentially expanding because it has a cosmological constant. Remember, a cosmological constant causes everything to fly apart. Here it is. Now, you can't see it flying apart because it's also perfectly homogeneous. But picture in your mind that this is a universe which is rapidly expanding. And it's a universe with a certain set of properties. The Calabi-Yau manifold that describes it, the fluxes that describe it, the particular bagel-shaped or pretzel-shaped geometries that describe it, describe a particular blue universe. Well, nearby, meaning to say, if you change things a little bit, there's another kind of universe, or another kind of possibility, which I've represented by red here. You started with a blue universe, which was expanding rapidly, but nearby, in the space of possibilities, there's another kind of space, another kind of property. Perhaps we remove a flux, put in an extra flux, bend the manifold a little bit, whatever. And what tends to happen in a rapidly expanding universe is bubbles form. Bubbles of this kind of space embedded in this kind of space. This is a mathematical thing that has been explored by relativists, by particle physicists, by quantum physicists for years. These little bubbles form, there's one of them, these little bubbles form with a different property. They begin to expand. And as they expand, they create new bubbles. Those new bubbles have a slightly different property. Perhaps in this bubble over here, perhaps there are a different kind of Calabi-Yau manifold describing space at this point. The enormous diversity of possibilities starts manifesting itself in bubbles, small bubbles which expand and expand, and eventually a little green bubble forms. a little green bubble that started with blue, and made a transition to red, red to black, black to green, and eventually the entire set of possibilities gets populated. In other words, the universe, according to this picture, is full of regions of space, all diverse, with different properties, which I represented here by different colors. Well, green is a nice color. Green is a good color for life, and green happens to be where we are. That's the basic idea, which is going in now into combining string theory with ideas from cosmology. Now, these ideas have a robust mathematics associated with them, which I haven't tried to explain to you. This is called eternal inflation, and eternal inflation creates a bit of everything, a bit of all possibilities. All of the possibilities that are inherent in string theory are created someplace. Well, that's the basic idea, that the universe is enormously diverse, and in some very small fraction of it, the cosmological constant is right, the properties of the electron are right, the properties of the neutron are right, gravity is weak by 42 orders of magnitude, but most of the universe, according to this picture, would be extremely hostile to our own existence. And the answer why are the laws of nature what they are is at least in part because we are here to observe them. In other words, the same logic that the fish was stuck with in the end. They could not explain their own environment. They could only say it was one of a great many environments. Now, first of all, let me just draw to your attention the biological analogy, which I've already said, but let me say it again. There is an enormous number of possibilities for putting together a DNA molecule. A DNA molecule has about a billion base pairs. You can arrange them, rearrange them, in an enormous variety of ways. That's the number of ways you can rearrange a DNA molecule. A huge number, much bigger than that 10 to the 500. That means there's an enormous diversity of possible life forms. All of those possible life forms are possible. There is a space of blueprints, the space of possibilities of a DNA molecule. You can think of as a space of blueprints for life. It doesn't tell you why all of this life got here. It just tells you there's a lot of possible life. How did it get here? Well, it got here by Darwinian evolution, which was a branching process. A branching process not so dissimilar from this bubble formation where species branched and branched and branched and branched. Random mutation happened. It tried out everything and eventually produced a bit of everything. The question, why did I wake up this morning being an intelligent creature? Well, the answer is simple. If I weren't an intelligent creature, I wouldn't have woke up and asked the question. Everything gets produced, you are simply one of many. Every possible environment gets produced, we are one of many, but we happen to be one that we can live in. And that may be the end of the story. All right. Let me go to the final question then. Are the laws of physics more Darwinian? Meaning to say, the result of random mutations, random changes, random bubble nucleations, and that filled an enormous landscape of possibilities, diverse, and are they more environmental than we thought, or are the laws of nature, as physicists used to think, some still do, written in stone in the form of some very basic fundamental equation, which if we solved it, we would explain why nature is exactly the way it is. That is the question which is before us now. Now, all I'm going to do, and that is the nature of the controversy, that is the nature of the questions which are being sought now, or attempted to answer by physicists. We don't have a complete answer to it. I have my prejudices. I've decided to end the lecture by telling you more or less, as I understand it, what some of the greatest theoretical physicists in the world think about it. If your picture is not on here, it does not mean that I think you're not a great theoretical physicist. It simply means that I couldn't find your picture on the internet. That's Edward Witten. Edward Witten is not only one of the greatest physicists in the world, he's one of the greatest mathematicians in the world, and he has always hoped, I would use the word prayed, but physicists, some of them pray, some of them don't pray, I don't know if they pray or not, but he has always hoped that the answer would be a unique mathematical explanation, and that life would simply be a an accidental consequence. He has always believed that string theory would have, he is a string theorist, of course. Some people think of him as the string theorist. He has always hoped that there would be a unique answer. Well, what is Ed's position now? Ed is very smart. He doesn't hold on indefinitely to ideas that he knows won't work. His view of it now is that the most likely explanation is the random Darwinian type of explanation. That string theory is very rich. It is not a theory of uniqueness, but it's a theory of diversity, and the universe may very well be filled with lots of different environments. But if you were to ask him, what do you hope for? His hope is still, hope springs eternal. He hopes that somebody is going to find a different explanation, which will again lead back to uniqueness. So it's an emotional response which is different than the emotional response that I have to it. I like that. This is David Gross. David Gross won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago, together with Frank Wilczek. They won the Nobel Prize for quantum chromodynamics, the theory of the nucleus, basically. They won the theory of the subnuclear nucleus. David is also extremely smart, obviously, and he also knows that this is a possible explanation, an important possible explanation, but he fears it. He fears it seriously, and not only fears it, but thinks that it's very dangerous. Why does he think it's dangerous? He thinks it's dangerous because if young people start accepting the idea that the world is the way it is just for random reasons, and that there is no mathematical explanation, they will stop looking for a mathematical explanation. He also fears that if physics is not predictive, then we lose our credibility in the face of our enemies. And what he means by enemies is the religious community, which would like to say that the universe was designed by an intelligence. So his objection to it, which I think needs to be taken seriously, is that it's dangerous, but nevertheless, he cannot find an alternative for the idea of the populated landscape. This very handsome man over here is a very serious, very poignant-looking person, is Steven Weinberg. Steven Weinberg is certainly by now one of the great believers in the anthropic idea, the idea that the universe is diverse, that that we live in places where we can live, and that's the end of the story. He has advocated that point of view for many years now. As I said, he is probably the most eminent, or one of the most eminent physicists in America. These are two younger physicists. Well, neither of them are very young anymore. Juan Maldacena and Ashok Sen, who are two of the most brilliant string theorists in the world, if not the most brilliant theoretical physicists in the world. Both of them have the same opinion as Ed Witten, that, well, looks like we might be stuck with this idea, but damn it, we hope it's not true. Here's Joe Polchinski again. Joe Polchinski is one of the few people who changed his mind. Actually, everybody's in the process of changing their mind a little bit, but he suddenly changed his mind. He's the one, together with Raphael Gusso, who discovered the fact that there are so many possibilities in string theory, 10 to the 500. As soon as he discovered that, he changed his mind, and he said, yes, the world may be very diverse, we may be just living in the kind of part that we can live in. So Joe, one of the most famous physicists in the world, is a partisan of the anthropic idea, as is the famous gentleman in the wheelchair, Stephen Hawking, who has always believed that the anthropic idea, the idea of diversity, the idea of we live where we can live, he has always believed that. Here's Frank Wilczek. Frank Wilczek, I think, has the most balanced viewpoint of all. He says, look, the universe may be very big. It may vary from different place to different place. It's our job to find out which things vary and which don't vary. And we got to sink our teeth into that problem and figure it out. And we shouldn't reject it. because it's a reasonable possibility. Let's figure it out. And he sits around trying to figure it out. That seems to be a good, healthy response. These are three famous cosmologists, André Linde, Alan Guth, Martin Rees. Martin Rees is Sir Martin Rees. He is the president of the Royal Society. Alan Guth is the inventor of inflationary cosmology. André Linde is one of the great also fathers of inflationary cosmology. These are three very famous cosmologists. The two outer ones here are very firm believers in the idea of a very big and diverse universe in which the anthropic constraint that we live in it determines to some extent the laws of nature. Alan Guth is also a believer in an enormously diverse universe, but not being a string theorist, he is not yet committed to the idea that there are so many vacuums, so many possibilities. He sits on the fence. He sits on the fence about all of this, and every so often I see Alan and I say, Alan, well, I call him a sort of closet anthropicist. What's the word for a person who believes in an anthropoid? I call him a clown. I say, Alan, have you come out of the closet yet? And Alan looks at me and smiles and says, not yet, but the door is opening. So Alan sits on the fence. And last, and certainly not least, is to my mind, the greatest of us all, Gerard, which is sometimes pronounced Gerard. Gerard Etouft, famous Dutch physicist, Nobel Prize winner, who in my opinion is the greatest of us all, who has seen further and seen deeper. His position is, oh well, 10 to the 500 vacuums, that's not so bad. It could have been worse. There could have been an infect number. He basically, his view is essentially, we should not be so arrogant as to automatically dismiss a possibility just because we didn't like it in the past. And he's open-minded about it. That's the current situation. There are a few famous physicists I haven't included here, either because I don't know their opinion, or because I couldn't find their picture, or because I really don't think they're so great. But and that's the story. That's what I came to tell you, and I hope you've enjoyed learning a little bit about what's going on. Thank you.
Sign the books for anybody who wants his personal signature on the book. The bookstore is selling them outside. And now we have some time for some questions or microphones.
I want to say one thing. I didn't know the books were on sale here. Man, they're beautiful.
Well, now you know. So there are microphones on either side here. If you have a question, please go to one of the microphones. And it's not on, turn it on. So we'll begin with the gentleman in the red sweater over there.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you for the lecture. It's very good. I have a question or a concern about entropy argument. It was used to imply a diversity in some place in the universe.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that it doesn't necessarily imply that at all, that it may imply a fourth possibility, which was not mentioned, which is that there's possibly a non-reducible substance. In other words, pure reason and pure empiricism cannot be reduced in isolation, but be held in synthesis, much like Hegel's dialectic or Wilbur's philosophy.
Well, let me interrupt you for a second. You're speaking the language of philosophy, and that's fine. I have no objection to it. But I have to say that my own instincts and my own genetic makeup is the genetic makeup of a mechanic, not a philosopher. And so I tend to approach this whole subject the way a car mechanic would approach a broken car trying to figure out what's wrong with it. And I never did understand how dialectic materialism helps you fix your car. So I'm not cutting you off. I just want to tell you that I don't have that kind of philosophical instinct, and I often don't know what the words mean.
I do, and I am a scientist.
Thank you.
As we will alternate, so the gentleman over on the left, please. Sing it on.
No lie.
Not yet.
Just shout. Shout.
Shout.
Okay, so my question is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, have we already, through our telescope, seen to the very edges of the universe? And if we have observed the universe all the way to the edge, wouldn't we have found some of these anomalies that have these alternate laws of physics by now?
Good question. The answer is by no means have we seen to the edge of the universe. We know, as a matter of fact, by measuring the curvature of the universe, by measuring the curvature of space, which we find to be very, very flat, incidentally, we know that the universe is at least 10 times bigger than the parts that we can see with any telescope and probably that we ever will be able to see. According to inflationary theory, the universe could well be 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 10 times bigger. So the answer is no. When people say we've seen to the edge of the universe, they simply mean that they have seen to the edge of what they can see. They mean the same thing. They mean the same thing as saying you look out, you're on a ship and you look out at the horizon and you say, I've looked out to the edge of the world. No, you haven't looked out to the edge of the world. You've looked out as far as you can see. That's what people mean when they say they've seen to the edge of the universe. They mean they've seen to the edge of what they can see. Is there anything out beyond that? We are certain that there is, because the universe is so flat. So for the same reason that Columbus might have deduced that the universe was very big, just by looking at how flat the surface of the Earth was, we can deduce that the universe is at least minimum 10 times bigger than the part than what we can see. Does that answer your question?
So, please.
Thank you. Enjoyed your talk. Very late question. Is our observable universe related to his, a green universe? I mean, is that what we're seeing? Basically, a second question.
Is our universe related to?
No, is our observable universe, as you showed up there in your slide, a green universe?
That's what I intended,
that our observable universe
is the little green universe. There might be other types which are a little bit different, which life could also exist in. It doesn't say life can only exist in our particular kind of universe, but my intention was, yes, that was the little green universe was our kind.
A quick follow-up, then, the laws of physics that we understand that apply to our entire observable universe.
It is virtually certain that the laws of physics, and what I mean by the laws of physics, incidentally, is the laws of physics, the laws of particle physics, the Rube Goldberg machine that I showed in the beginning, not the overarching laws which tell you what all the possible laws are, but the laws of physics as we understand them appear to be the same in all observable parts of the universe.
Great.
As far as we can tell, what we are seeing is all the same everywhere, but it appears to be a very, very small portion of something much bigger.
Yeah. And what would happen if a brown universe were to appear right next door to us? We don't know.
Okay. Let's ask it slightly differently. What would happen if right in this room a brown bubble appeared and started to expand? You don't want to know.
Thank you.
You're buried in brown. It wouldn't be good for you.
You have a question over there?
Yes. My question is, on the diagram you showed, there's a couple of different, portion of the universe we're looking at. And you are saying the physical laws are different at different regions. The question is, can information be transmitted between those different regions, or not?
In the simplest sense of transmitting information, no.
Then the question goes, and that means that the concept can be only predicted by theoretical method, and that we will never have any experimental proofs or results more from that?
Well, I would say that remains to be seen. One of the things that is possible is that we can look back into our past and discover that in our past, a different environment existed. Now, we already looked back into our past, and we have seen, at least we think we've seen, that a different environment, a very different environment, a very different point on the landscape dominated our past. It's called the plateau, the inflationary plateau, or the vacuum energy that existed in the early past when inflation was taking place. In principle, now how hard this is we don't know, but in principle we could look back into the past and not see other universes which are way out there, but discover the fact that our own universe, our own local region, may have been different in the past and may have had different laws of nature. And basically we already know that's true. So I think it's the past where we need to look in order to try to see these things directly.
On the right.
I'm just a biologist trying to get a feel for some of these concepts, and one that's been around a lot longer is the Big Bang. Does that just apply to your green bubble or not?
No, they all bang. They all bang, and they all have pretty much the same kind of Big Bang at the very beginning, but then some of them just expand so fast and so rapidly that life never, that nothing ever gets a chance to form before they've just diluted themselves away. Some of them recollapse in a hurry and nothing much happens in them because they just recollapse. A handful of them, the parameters are such that they continue to expand, and they expand slowly enough that that they don't just dilute themselves away to nothing. Something is left over, and the material forms in them. They all bang, but whether they bang too fast or too slow or just right is a delicate balance. It could be too fast, it could be too slow, and there's a delicate balance that needs to be struck in order for things to exist.
Hello. I was just curious to know from the string theory that I've read and even the left that I've understood, the geology major, is that the string theory or the strings themselves, as they contract and oscillate different resonance frequencies to create photons of the different particles at those junctures. Could you expand upon that a little bit more, maybe in relation to quantum mechanics?
Ooh.
Or is it not expandable?
Yeah, no, it is certainly expandable. It's the sort of thing that I would have to take 15 or 20 minutes to expand on. So that's the kind of thing that I think takes a little more time. It can be done by email, it can be done over a cup of coffee, it can be done in front of a blackboard, but I think it's not something that I want to try to do in front of an audience right now. It's not that I'm embarrassed to do it in front of an audience. It's that it's too complicated a question to take up in this particular venue, I think. But email is a possible way to deal with it. Subscribe at stanford.edu.
A couple more questions over on the right first.
Yeah. So as I understand it, you basically argue that the laws of nature are variable throughout the universe, but just in our very small reference frame. That they're constant. They're constant in such a way that in this life. But you mentioned that there's a bunch of other variables that you want to correct me on.
Yeah. There's a bunch of other variables.
There's a bunch of other variables that you mentioned aren't necessarily important or not necessary for.
There are some things which are important. There are some things which aren't.
Right
now, for example, another variable that occurs in nature is called the fine structure constant. It's basically the magnitude of the electric charge. The electric charge of an electron could probably vary a good deal and not destroy chemistry. It can't be any old number. It can't be too small because then atoms would be bigger than the size of the Earth. It can't be too big because otherwise the electron would be buried inside the nucleus. But there's probably a pretty good range.
Right, right. So you say that there's certain laws that need to be fixed exactly as they are.
The cosmological constant and the strength of gravity being two that are especially fine-tuned.
And if there are other variables that aren't required to be constant, and you have a universe where the variables fluctuate all over the place,
yes.
Isn't it likely then, wouldn't it be a little surprising to find that the variables that don't impact us if they were constant too, wouldn't that be sort of a coincidence?
Let me tell you what the name of variables which vary within our own universe is. And there are many of them. They are called fields. A field is a thing which varies from place to place within our own universe. Electric fields, magnetic fields, Higgs field, this field, that field, they do vary. And we know that they do vary. So we just think of them as local environments.
So the ones that are the ones that need to remain constant, we find constant throughout the universe. But the ones that don't have to,
that's right. Or I would say it the opposite way: the ones which are constant throughout the universe and sort of frozen are the ones we tend to identify with laws of nature, with laws of physics. The ones which vary smoothly from place to place for one reason or another, we tend to just call environmental variation within our own universe. So it's natural to identify the ones which are sort of frozen with the ones which we identify with the laws of nature. Let me give you an example of bubbles expanding. Supercooled water is? Supercooled water is water which is so cold that it's below the freezing temperature, but if you freeze it very, very slowly, you can keep it liquid below the freezing temperature. What happens if a little bit of ice forms, a little bubble of ice forms? Well, that disturbs the neighboring molecules around it and causes them to form more ice. And that ice begins to expand and creates a bigger and bigger bubble, a bigger and bigger chunk of ice in the water. The reason is because ice has less energy than water. And so once that ice gets started, because it has less energy, it starts to expand, and the expansion, it happens because the ice has less energy and it's more favorable to create ice. Anybody know the story of Cat's Cradle? Ice Nine, there was a form of water, an imaginary form of it. This is Kurt Vonnegut. The best way to understand how bubbles nucleate and what happens is to read Cat's Cradle, Kurt Vonnegut's book, Ice Nine. Ice Nine was an imaginary form of water which was more stable than ordinary water at room temperature, and if a little bit of it got started, it would start to eat up all of the water and create a bigger and bigger bubble. Another example is bubbles of steam forming in hot water. When a bubble of steam forms, you'll notice it starts to expand. And the reason is because in a certain sense, the steam has less energy than the water, and it reduces the energy of the bucket of water to expand the size of the steam bubble. So it's very much like any other kind of bubble forming and expanding. If the bubble has less energy, and what's inside the bubble has less energy, it will start to expand. Nope.
I guess maybe just one more question over on the right here.
Thank you. I wanted to let everybody know that I'm a science and technology studies major here at UC Davis. Very cool major. Should check out some of the classes. The reason I mention this is because I'm about to ask you a science and technology studies question. Okay, so you mentioned that you're more of a mechanic, not a philosopher. And I would like to suggest, and please let me know if anyone else has brought this up before, that one of your main points that you brought up is actually a philosophical argument rather than a scientific one. So the argument I'm referring to is the reason why the universe is like it is because we're here to observe it. Now, that's...
Well, I don't really subscribe to that way of saying it. The way that I like to say it is the universe is very big, very varied, has lots and lots of different environments, and it should not be a surprise to anybody that we live in the small part of it where life is possible. That's the way I like to say it.
Okay. That's roughly the same question, though. Now, I know you said that you're not a philosopher, but I would like to, I have heard this, addressed this argument before, and that this argument actually commits a logical fallacy, which I forget what the name is, but I can describe to you the scenario of why it's fallacious, if I may. It's relatively short. And then I want to hear your response. Is that okay?
Okay.
So let's suppose that I go up to the front of the room and we decide to find people who have the best eyesight, the best like gun aiming capacity, and we get them with sniper rifles standing only a few feet away from me and tell them to aim at me and shoot at me. Okay. And we do this with like say 15 people. So we have 15 sniper rifles, 15 people, they're standing about 15 feet away from me. Okay, and we tell them to fire.
What?
Did you catch the scenario?
Sorry, I just.
Okay, so we tell the people that are pointing all their guns at me to fire.
Rifles.
The punchline is coming up after this right now.
I often have to admit I sort of feel that exactly.
Okay. So the point of this analogy is they shoot the rifles. They all shoot the rifles, and I'm still there standing. I haven't been hit, I'm not dead. And you ask me, why are you standing there? And I respond, well, of course I'm standing here. I wouldn't be here to respond and observe the fact that I'm standing here if I wasn't.
Yeah. My answer to that is, would you say the same thing to the fish and the cosmologists who had predicted that there are a lot of environments out there? They got it right. I think you would agree they got it right. So I think before you ask that question, you should ask yourself, would you have been, if you had been a physicist or a fish philosopher, would you have asked the cosmologist exactly the same question and attacked them on exactly the same grounds? Because there you would have been wrong.
Why?
Because there really is a world out there that is very diverse and full of diversity, and the reason that fish live where they live is because they couldn't live otherwise. That is really true. I think most of us would agree that that is the explanation of why fish live on a liquid water planet, because they can't live anywhere else.
It's true.
I'd like to thank all of you for coming this evening. Let's give Lenny one more big hand, and maybe you'll take a few.